This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The slow money movement was inspired by the slow food movement, and its principles are fairly simple. Bring money back down to earth. Slow money down. Invest in where you live and in food, farms, and fertility. Simple, yes, but radical too, because it also asks the following questions. What would the world be like if we invested, say, 50% of our assets within 50 miles of where we live? What if there were 50% more organic matter in our soil 50 years from now? On today's program, we're going to explore the slow money movement here in North Carolina, and we're going to ask, what happens if the principles of slow money are applied to all capital investing, not just investing in farms and food? And to help us, we've asked Carol Pepe Hewitt of Slow Money NC to join us, and Bonnie Mollenbrock is the Executive Director of SJF Institute and Investor Circle. Kathy Clark is with us as well, an Adjunct Associate Professor at the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Welcome to all of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Great to be here.
Carol Pepe Hewitt, let's talk about the slow money movement here in North Carolina. What is it?
Well, it's a very exciting new project that got started a couple of years ago. Woody Tash came to town. He wrote a book called Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, and he was inspired by the slow food movement and the idea of investment. And he put the two together came up with the idea that we ought to do exactly what you just said. We ought to try to take some of our money and slow it down instead of sending it out to Wall Street to bring it back and invest it locally. And it's no coincidence that we're here on tax day. I just put a sizable check in the mail, and it went out to, you know, a faraway place. It went out to the government, and I'm sure they'll spend it, sensibly. But when we send out our investments, our retirement income, we lose control of that virtually. I mean, we may have some idea where it is, but not really. With slow money, you have complete control. So people right here in our community that would never get a commercial loan, Frank over at 9th Street Bakery wanted to put a deck on his bakery and add kombucha. And that's not the kind of thing that a bank is going to want to bother with because it's small.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that. So, Frank, you're talking about a small business right here in Durham, North Carolina.
Right.
9th Street Bakery. It's not because he's got a bad business. Been a business for a long time. He's a good risk. It's just that it's not worth the bank's time and effort
for
the amount of money he needs.
That's right. A small loan of $20,000, $5,000, $30,000. We loaned TS Designs in Burlington farmed the first organic cotton ever grown in North Carolina. They're going to make that into T-shirts, but there was a moment in time where the farmers had to be made whole on that cotton. So five people invested $6,000. Bought a whole bunch of organic cotton, and now they're getting paid back as those T-shirts are selling.
Let's talk about those five people and your role there. Are you kind of a broker? Do you find the people who have the money to lend to these projects?
Oh, I wouldn't call myself a broker. I'm probably a matchmaker, or maybe it's a slow money escort service. So we have a website where people can go in and take a look and pledge some amount of money that they would like to loan in their community, and there's another place on the website where they can put in a borrower information form. And I simply send the information from the borrower project, the potential entrepreneur, on to someone who has pledged $5,000, $30,000, and they take a look at it. So it's completely in the hands and in the control of the lender who they choose to lend to, and hopefully it'll be someone that they know. Well, they will meet them.
How do you identify those lenders or potential lenders, people who want to invest in this kind of thing?
Well, you know, it's been fascinating. When I first heard about this 2 years ago, I couldn't have told you that I would have now moved $535,000 from people's private funds, as low as $500 to as high as $25,000, into the local food shed. So we now have farms and local restaurants and a cheese shop here, Reliable Cheese.
Tell me what you mean. You just used the phrase food shed. Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Mm. Well, in the same way that you have a watershed, that's where you get your water. We have a food shed, which is where we get our food. But if you go into the grocery store today, chances are you'll find little or no locally produced food in most large grocery stores. Certainly, if you do a drive-through in a restaurant, you're not going to get a bite of local lettuce. We have to change that. If we're going to eat decades from now, we may wish that we had a lot more small-scale sustainable farms in our community. So slow money supports sustainable farming. It's bringing soil fertility back So any of the businesses that also promote small farming. So you're talking about the local restaurants that Angelina's Kitchen down in Pittsboro serves Screech's tomatoes. And
again, tell us what's the difference, because if I've got this idea, look, people in this area know about sustainable agriculture. I'm a farmer. I want to grow this stuff. I know how to do it. I'm good at it. I'm a restaurateur. I can make a restaurant work. Why can't they go to a bank? Why do they have to come to some other outlet?
Yeah, well, in this day and age, the commercial lending has really dried up. And again, these are small loans. Even when we had commercial loans available, it's just there's just not enough money in it. And so with slow money, we keep our overhead down to next to nothing. I can operate out of a laptop, and we don't have a brick and mortar. We operate as a nonprofit. We're tucked under the Abundance Foundation down in Pittsburgh. That is a wonderful umbrella organization, nonprofit that works on sustainable energy, local foods and community. And so we're able to do this at, and the lender will receive something like 2-4%, very, very, very affordable loans. And they're not doing it exclusively for the money. They are getting their money back. This is not philanthropy. But on the other hand, they're not going to make a ton of money. They're doing it because they care, because they have, this is a mission that matters to them.
That's the interesting part of the model. It's not Kickstarter. I'm not giving you the money, or it's not a nonprofit. I'm not giving it away. I'm receiving money, but there's a possible loss in terms of the amount of money I might have received elsewhere, although gosh knows where. I mean, I guess the markets are doing well. And I'm taking that potential loss, slight loss.
Right.
But so and this is all about food, Chad. This is about local food when you talk about – when you use the phrase slow money. But Bonnie Mollenbrock from SJF Institute and Investor Circle, tell us about this model on a larger scale. Does it work? And tell us what you do.
Sure. So I'm the executive director of, as you said, SJF Institute and Investor Circle. And SJF Institute's been based here in Durham for the past 10 years. And we've been working with entrepreneurs who are looking to generate positive impacts for their companies, whether it's social or environmental, for the past 10 years. And we merged with a nonprofit organization called Investor Circle last summer, with the goal of helping both investors and entrepreneurs sort of be the matchmaker, bring these two together, and accelerate these kind of companies. So Investor Circle is a 20-year-old network of impact investors. There's angel investors and foundations and small venture capital funds that have been investing in higher growth companies over the past 20 years. So when you think about how this compares, they're investing equity by and large. This is, you know, not debt and looking for loans, but ownership, partial ownership in the company, on earlier stage companies that aren't able to pay perhaps debt yet. And are looking to grow and scale. And so you think of companies like Stonyfield Farm, Earth's Best, Baby Food.
How about
Zipcar
here in North Carolina?
And here in North Carolina, we are excited. Just recently, we have a IC local network that's getting going and looking at companies every month. And investors have recently made an investment in Schoolhouse, which is a ethically sourced collegiate apparel company founded by a Duke alum who was concerned about sweatshop production of clothing. And so she was a Fulbright scholar, went to Sri Lanka to study ethical production, fair trade production of clothing, and figured that out, created a company to do just that and provide, you know, your Duke t-shirts, your UNC t-shirts that are fair trade sourced. Last year, she got excited about the impacts that was having in Sri Lanka and said, what could we do? Could we bring that home to North Carolina, formerly textile-based economy here in North Carolina? We saw so much of that lead. She said, could we bring it back? She succeeded in bringing much of that production back to North Carolina, working with 10 supply chain providers that are doing the cutting and sewing. A worker-owned co-op in Morganton is one of those that is, you know, a key partner of hers in that. That's now creating and so helping to support 2,700 jobs here in North Carolina. So there are opportunities to help companies grow at a faster rate and have broader impact as well, by this kind of investing more broadly.
So it seems some of the key differences in what you're doing at that level and what's happening at the slow money level is, number one, you're talking about equity investment, meaning I get a piece of the business versus a loan at which I get an interest rate as my return. And the other thing is, maybe the investors don't live here, there may not be that kind of local connection. What about that? Is there anything lost in sort of not knowing where your money's going?
Well, I think that's a key thing to point out, that just because the investors are not all here, that does not mean there's not a local connection. One thing that our network does is create those opportunities to get together. So next week we have our biannual venture fair in San Francisco where we bring entrepreneurs and investors together. They have an opportunity to meet each other and generate those relationships. We had a deal that came out of our Philadelphia local network. That was a company they were supporting there. They brought it to the national network because it needed more investment. So again, those it helped build relationships. So I think key to all this and to a capitalism that I think we can all be very proud of and can work most efficiently and equitably is these relationships. And key to our network is developing those, even if people aren't necessarily in the same hometown. That's a critical part that we see of these investment relationships. These investors are providing more than just money. They're providing, they may sit on the board, they may, you know, they have expertise in the area. We looked, entrepreneurs expect
and
that.
Is this,
well.
So this is something that your impact investors really want as part of the deal. There may
yes.
be some opportunity cost in what their return, but what they want is more engagement. So you can actually broker those kind of networks. And I guess that's what's going on naturally, Carol, in your network because people are living here. They know exactly where Frank is on Main Street or where Reliable Cheese is. Mm-hmm. And they make those commitments.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll be going down to Wilmington on Wednesday night because there's a group that's getting started in Wilmington, North Carolina, and a young man named Mark is very interested in opening a sustainable sushi restaurant, which will be the first of its kind in the East Coast. And he just needs a few more $1,000s to get open.
On the State of Things today, talking about slow money and impact investing with Carol Pepe Hewitt of Slow Money NC, Bonnie Mollenbrook of the SJF Institute and Investor Circle. Our conversation continues on the State of Things in a moment from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District, talking about slow money movement in North Carolina, how it relates to impact investing. With me, Carol Pepe Hewitt of Slow Money NC, Bonnie Mollenbrock, the Executive Director of SJF Institute and Investor Circle. Kathy Clark is with us. She's an Adjunct Associate Professor at the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke. And Kathy, you've been listening to this conversation. So one of the questions that comes up, it seems to me, in all of this is risk. What about risk in this sort of new world of investment? Is it inherently more risky?
It's a great question. All investment has some risk attached to it, and a lot of the things that Carol and Bonnie have been talking about really fall into the realm of early stage investing. Any kind of investment has some sort of a risk. It's much more risky to invest in something before everything it's said is kind of pumping out cash. There is perception in the marketplace that if something is good for people and the planet, that perhaps it's not as good for your pocket. And that's just simply not necessarily the case. There are some instances where there's a trade-off between what we call financial return and social return, but there are a lot of instances where those things are very well aligned. A good example of that is kind of the field that you know really got impact investing off the ground, even though the words didn't exist then, which is microfinance, which is a global practice of trying to create small peer networks, started in Bangladesh actually almost 30 years ago by the Nobel Prize winner Muhammad Yunus, who put together the Grameen Bank and let groups of very poverty-stricken women start to get loans in peer groups, and they were responsible for every peer paying back the loan or else the whole group would default. And it turns out this model has driven a tremendous amount of both important social impact and people pay back the loans. Their payback repayment rate is over 98%. We've learned some things about how to do this well and how not to do it well, but the trade-off really depends on and is not necessarily more risky.
Well, you know, Carol, I want to ask you, Kathy, as an academic, to assess this intangible, this kind of these personal relationships, and to what extent mm-hmm. we could ever measure the fact that people know who lent them the money, and the people who lent them the money are intimately interested in their business. It seems intangible, but when you look at the high payback and the low delinquency and default rate that surrounds some of these loans, is that something we should be measuring? Is that a factor in actually encouraging people to pay back their loans?
It's a really fascinating thing, right? Because the kind of direct connection that Carol was talking about that happens in these local communities around the slow money lending, and the kinds of direct connections that Bonnie has been talking about that happen when an angel invests, for example, in a startup company and gets on the board, are really completely different from most of the tools and trends in the global financial marketplace, which really looks to figure out how do we aggregate a lot of things happening very quickly with very little friction, very little relationship, and create submarkets kind of as fast as you can. One of the reasons microfinance has succeeded is because big pension funds like Vanguard and Fidelity and TIA Cref and others in Europe have been pumping large amounts of debt capital into funds that then pump it into other funds that then finally give it to end users. So we have kind of two simultaneous trends, and I think, I don't think anyone has been able to put a dollar value on the high-touch way of doing this, but there are a lot of groups working to expand it and to show how it can be just as successful.
Carol, from the ground level, when you work on these loans and bring people together, what's your sense of the impact of knowing the person who gave you the loan, and now you got to run a business?
For the borrower, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting.
Because you have, at this point, you have no defaults, I think.
We have no defaults. We have done about 40 of these loans.
Right. So you're a tender young business, but you're pretty good, doing pretty well
so far.
Yeah,
I've done about 40 of these loans have happened and about 30 lenders, because several people, interestingly enough, once you do one, you want to do another and another and another. Because you have built these relationships. For the borrower, first of all, they're deeply appreciative. I have to say, you've helped make someone's dream come true. This is a loan that, you know, they may have gotten some from family and some from here and there, but if they just had, that last $5,000, they could actually get those doors open. There's a miller, the North Carolina Organic Bread Project up in Asheville. She is going to mill grain. So you know what farm it was grown on in North Carolina, goes up to Asheville, gets ground. She was all done. She was already open, and she ran into some electrical overruns, and slow money helped her. Three people gave her $5,000, and she was able to get her doors open. So, you know, it's that kind of extra. And I think mainly they're deeply appreciative.
Right, because you're invested and it's your neighbor, and you know exactly where to find her. You know, it's like that last scene in It's a Wonderful Life. Everybody dumping their buckets of money on old George. So but let me ask you, Bonnie, because what Kathy said something interesting about Kiva and the microfinancing. And if you look at it from the borrower's side, of course, it gets them in business. But the other thing is the business came from them. So the model is not the IMF telling you what infrastructure you need and here's the money to go make it. It's somebody in a neighborhood saying, you know, if only we had bicycles, we could actually get the jackets to the market. To what extent is that an important part of this model, the fact that people in local communities are figuring out precisely the need of their community?
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, Investor Circle is driven by great entrepreneurs that have a dream also of changing the world for the better and having impact. And that's inspiring to the investors. And they partner together. They're taking very high risk together. It's early stage. They know that some of these are going to fail, but it's worth that risk to create these impacts. And so that, I think, drives these relationships and the commitment of both parties. And it's inherent in that model.
I wanted to know if I could jump in here, because I think the other thing that interests us as an academic institution that's been studying social entrepreneurship for over 10 years now is, you know, that kind of innovation that you were talking about, Frank, of someone on the ground seeing a problem and then trying, like, kind of slowly working through, well, will this work? Will this work? Will this work? How do I get this into an enterprise that becomes an engine to scale or to spread the impact that they're having? There's been a tremendous amount of frustration in the social entrepreneurship field that people have found those solutions and then they can't scale them. And part of the reason they can't scale them is because they haven't been able to access capital markets that are delivering the right kind of capital for them to use effectively, and that understand the risk, that understand the market they're in, that understand their growth trajectory, that understand some of their constituents. A lot of these businesses are going to have completely different bases of constituents, whether it's the the local food loan where you know your neighbor, to something more complex like somebody who's providing renewable energy solar panels to a community in India that's never had energy beyond kerosene. What are those beneficiaries need? And the entrepreneur starts to understand that and then needs an investor that is aligned with the time and process that they are taking to meet those people's needs, which is just very different from how do I get my money back quick.
Right. Well, let's talk to one of those entrepreneurs now and see how he dealt with some of those very questions. I'd like to bring Michael Shore into the conversation. Michael Shore is the CEO of FLS Energy in Asheville. It's a solar energy company that's won some recognition and some awards for being both good for the environment and a healthy place to work, and so far a successful business. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Now, you've done some creative financing yourself for your customers. Explain how solar utility model works.
Okay, so FLS Energy is a solar utility, and that means that we sell clean, reliable energy to our clients. We engineer, build, operate, and finance our solar energy projects, and then part of our revenue stream comes from us selling the energy over time.
So you've got some money that you can then reinvest and help people who had invested, who you need to start their businesses and get going.
Right. So we're very capital we're very capital intensive. We take a lot of investment in. We develop projects, and then once a project is developed, we have that revenue to reinvest in the next project.
Now, that sounds like a dangerous combination. On the one hand, to be an investor, and on the other hand, have a core business of providing a utility. Is it a complicated mix for you, and does it sometimes clash? Do those two priorities clash?
Actually, there's a lot of synergy between them. We are both a finance company as well as an engineering, procurement, and construction company. And because we're both financing and then owning the projects, we, one, have this long-term revenue stream that could keep the company financially healthy, but we also understand the solar technology very well, and so we can keep on designing and continually improving the projects that we develop.
Kathy Clark at the Fuqua School, I wonder if this sounds like one of the strategies the market might be looking for to find this new ways of financing these middle stages.
Sure. I mean, there are all sorts of different exciting innovations going on, both within companies like Michael's model and across the sector. And it's one of the things that we're looking at. We have a new initiative here at Duke looking at impact investing. And, one of the things that we're looking at is some of the effectiveness of the innovation on the financial side.
Michael, is there anything about this particular climate, this financial climate now in the wake of 2008, that makes what you're doing easier and more likely to succeed?
Surely as energy prices go up, conventional energy prices from coal and nuclear, that's of course good for the renewable energy sector. But actually, our financial model, our business model, is dependent on a healthy financial system, a healthy banking system. And so the fact that we were able to get through the recession and still grow during that time, that was a blessing. We started with 3 employees back in 2006. We have about 80 employees today, and we had a great partnership with Bank of America that carried us through. And now that the economy is strengthening, that's only good for our business.
Is this something that is replicable and scalable even further to make even larger, or is there something unique, do you think, about your situation?
Yeah, well, as a business, we have tried to find a unique selling proposition for our clients, so we're not necessarily going head-to-head with other solar energy companies. And we do think we have something that's very scalable. We early on, in 2008, we did about $1.5 million of business. Last year, we did $38 million of business. And we anticipate continuing to scale our business model. For example, a couple of weeks ago, we commissioned the largest solar hot water system in the country at an agricultural facility, Prestige, in eastern North Carolina, and we're installing and owning thousands of solar energy systems on housing at Camp Lejeune.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Shore is CEO of FLS Energy in Asheville, and you can find out more about that company at flsenergy.com. All of this raises questions that I think we touched on earlier, this kind of split personality we have about doing good with our philanthropic donations on the one hand and then turning a blind eye to where our investments may go to kind of keep us alive in our golden years, if that's where it's all headed. So let me ask you, Bonnie, about your investors, the people who come to Investment Circle. Are they coming to the idea that there's nothing dirty about earning some money and we can pay attention to where it goes? And really what I'm looking at is the scale, whether or not more and more people are coming to that understanding.
Absolutely, yes. There's greater and greater interest in that and about how to put more of their money to work in this way. And instead of thinking of these two separate buckets of, well, I make a bunch of money and then I donate it all to make good, the good things happen, they're saying, wait, I want to put a tenth or 50%. And some are saying, I want to put 100% of the money I have into these impact investing opportunities because now we're getting more and more vehicles, everything from socially responsible mutual funds to these kind of impact investing opportunities. And it's not only individuals that are doing this, but foundations are starting to look at the opportunity to take their, you know, the big corpus. So beyond just the 5% of grants that they do every year, but to say, gee, can we take part of our core money and make sure that it can be doing good too? And so there's a lot of movement in that regard. And that's very exciting because they have, you know, they also bring expertise in these social environmental challenges that they can put into their investment.
Now, how much of that interest do you think is because of the small gap in opportunity cost, the fact that interest rates are generally so low? I guess Wall Street's doing pretty well. But it doesn't look as bad these days to be investing in something that offers a small return because there aren't a lot of big returns out there. Should that change, would we see a big change in interest in this kind of impact investing?
I don't think it's going to go away. It was happening even before the recession. And so there's been a large push in that way. So I don't think it's going to go away. And people are looking to be more creative. I think a bigger barrier is the issues of fiduciary responsibility and what they're allowed to do with their money. And there's a lot of work there and saying, gee, you can put your money to good things that meet the mission of your foundation and are also serving your fiduciary responsibility to manage that money well and make sure you can continue to grant too.
When you talk about foundations, of course, they have a lot of rules governing where they can invest their money because of the amount of responsibility they have to their mission.
Exactly. And for donations to be charitable. Yes.
So, Carol, one of the issues in slow money is the velocity at which money travels now. I think the founder of the slow money movement points out that by 1960, 3 million shares changed hands on Wall Street, and now it's more like 5 billion, I think. So part of what this movement tries to get at is to get some control over where this money is going and the impact that it's having. It's traveling so fast, we have no idea what those other investments are doing.
I think that's true. David Orr was actually the one that said, you know, when money travels too fast, it becomes violent. I'm sorry, when water travels too fast, it becomes violent. And the same thing is true about money. When money travels too fast, it can become violent. I've heard that the same amount of money changes hands in one day in the stock market on Wall Street that exists in the entire world. And, you know, every time it changes hands, click, 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 there's money. Someone's making money on that. So in an interesting way, you're not paying those fees with your slow money loans. We went out to Tarboro to give a talk one night, and there were a few people in the room, and one woman raised her hand, and she said, you know, I'm a physician from Rocky Mount, and I've had it with the stock market. I've pulled all my money out, and I want to do something local. So there was a nice young couple in the back. He was a third-generation farmer and a butcher, and they were trying to get a butcher shop open, and they met after the meeting, and she helped them with a small $5,000 loan to consolidate some debt. And if you want to have some great thick-cut bacon, it's in Tarboro, Blazing Cattle. And she's done three other loans since then. So I think that's true. We have a lot of power. We vote with every dollar we spend. And we, because of the fear that we've been taught to have around our money, we don't think well about it. And we just give it away. We send it out to somebody else to plan it and spend it. And you know, Wall Street may be doing well now, but I don't know how your funds looked, you know, 2 years from now. But things, money just disappeared, and we had no idea. So we had no control.
Crashed three times in my tender
lifetime.
There you
go. So this is money you have control over.
So, Kathy Clark, that's the question. We've sort of framed this as what can people of conscience do with their money, and good news, there are some options. But is this a necessary move? Will we have to move to these models? Because is money traveling just far too fast to be sustainable for the markets?
I don't know if I can answer that question. You know, I think, as Bonnie said, you know, there's just more and more impetus from people of all ages, you know, to figure out how to integrate these things. The population that we deal with, the MBAs, this millennial generation, is completely convinced that it's not right to separate out your investments and your values. And, you know, just a tremendous amount of activity and interest in trying to figure out how to use their newfound business skills to make a difference and sustain themselves and their communities at the same time. So, you know, is it inevitable? You know, if you talk to some people from the sustainability community, they say it absolutely is, because we're working with a paradigm that is flawed in that the paradigm of our financial model is growth, and the paradigm of the earth is of scarce, limited resources. And at a certain point, you know, not every company can continue to grow and consume for us to live sustainably on the planet. So, you know, that's the argument with the 30,000-foot argument at that level is, you know, something's really got to change. And there's some amazing entrepreneurs and writers who have been carrying this message for quite some time and saying, until the capital markets change the way that they work, we're never really going to address some of the environmental sustainability issues that we have in front of us, because those are the engines that drive us at the moment.
We're going to continue this conversation. Kathy Clark at Fuqua, I'm going to ask you to stay with us. And then I also want to thank Carol Pepe Hewitt of Slow Money NC and Bonnie Mullenbrook, the Executive Director of SJF Institute and Investor Circle. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you
so much. It was wonderful.
We are going to continue our conversation on the state of things, and we're going to take a look at the Jobs Act, which encourages crowdfunding for equity investment. But is it safe? Are there enough rules? We'll take a look when our program continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We've been talking about the slow money movement in North Carolina, how that relates to ideas of practicing impact investment. Kathy Clark is with me. She's an adjunct associate professor at the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship at Duke University's Fuqua Business School. Kathy, at the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship, which you call CASE, you're working on an initiative related to impact investing. Tell us about that and tell us why.
Sure. So we are a research and education center here at the business school that's been concerned with the ability of entrepreneurs to have influence and impact on social and environmental problems. We've been doing this for about 10 years. And one of the things that has consistently come up is how do entrepreneurs scale their ideas to a scale that actually matters, that actually addresses enough people to, you know, as we call it, create system change or tip a system. I don't know if some people have read Malcolm Gladwell's book on the tipping point. This is the kind of thing that social entrepreneurs try to do. And it turns out that you need a lot of capital to try to do that. There are, you know, lots of stories of very successful organizations that have worked sometimes 10, sometimes 20, sometimes 30 years on problems in the United States and abroad and still have not gotten to the point where they've started to scale effectively. And we are interested in looking at this practice in the capital markets called impact investing. The word is new. The word is less than 5 years old. For the term, what it refers to is taking a dollar and trying to use your dollar to get both some sort of financial return, which is anything over zero, and then also create some sort of impact with that dollar, a social and environmental impact. And there's a lot of people who've been doing this for a long time, but the attention to this has grown recently. And so we're interested in studying it and exploring it and helping it out.
Of course, the big question is, what do you mean by impact? And who,
yeah, of course. And I've spent about 15 years thinking about that question.
But it does seem to me that one of the things you do when you bring more people involved and they become more engaged in where their money goes and what it's doing, that all of the, that all of these subjective judgments about what's good and what's bad for the planet, that they have an aggregate effect, and maybe bringing in more of that subjectivity may be just what the markets need instead of one or two
brokers.
They may
need both, right? There are efforts to understand that subjectivity. There's also some really exciting efforts here in the U.S. and globally around setting standards for what a very good company is. You know, what's a company that has managed to provide impact to a variety of its stakeholders, including its employees, its consumers and customers, and its shareholders and the community. And there's actually a new corporate form that is has been created now in 7 states around the U.S. called a benefit corporation, where you as a company can incorporate from the get-go and say, you know, I'm going to try to create this kind of value, and I'm going to have a third party tell you every year how well I'm doing. So we're making some progress.
And those B Corps, of course, are chartered in a way that say you should know right up front that that return on investment is not our top priority. And if we've announced that.
They don't say that. Some of them are aiming to be small and local, and some of them are aiming to grow and be financially very, very profitable. So there is no there's no hook between those two things.
Well, but regulation and some kind of standard is very important, and that really brings us to the next part of this discussion. And for that, I will introduce James Cox. He is the Brainerd Curie Professor of Law at Duke University. Jim, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you back.
Glad to be here, Frank.
So we've been talking about the impact investment, and then there is the jobs bill, this latest Jobs Act, J-O-B-S, which is Jumpstart Our Business Startups, right? President Obama signed it, had bipartisan support, and the main feature is something called crowdfunding, which we all know from Kickstarter and the rest, but it's being used now for equity investment. So tell us what this does.
Well, it's a radical step, historically anyway, for the securities laws, because much of the securities laws focus upon disclosure, and then you can avoid the heavy hand of regulated disclosure if you sold securities to individuals who are sophisticated and experienced investors. And what the crowdfunding provision does to the Jobs Act is it throws out one aspect of that. There's still disclosure that has to occur in connection with these offerings that are pursuant to crowdfunding, but it doesn't pay attention to the experience of the investors themselves. Now, the governor on that, the kind of protective provision, is that there's a limit on how much an individual investor can invest in various crowdfunding projects in a 12-month period. That limit goes from $2,000 to $100,000 of an investment, depending on that person's net worth and income. So
it's protecting the investor and saying you can only put so much of your rent money into this.
Exactly.
Right? Well, it solves this problem, right? It attempts to, right? We can't get money to these small projects, and that's what we think is going to get the economy going. Let's get some small businesses up and running, hire people, and go. Banks won't do it. Let's use Kickstarter.
Yeah, Kickstarter is kind of an interesting phenomenon, because when you look at that and various websites that were operating in Europe, that it was not clear that these were investments being made in the sense of people were looking for a financial return. Right. They were much along the lines of what some of your other guests were saying, making investments in what they believe was a value to society. Right. Wanted to see this album made, for example, or this rock group go on a tour. And we're not looking and did not receive any financial return.
Right. So there's no return on investment. You know you're giving it away with Kickstarter. This is new. We are expecting some kind of a return. What's the problem here? Is there are some concerns that without these regulations, somebody's going to get snookered.
What we really worry about is not the entrepreneur as such. What we worry about is that we've always had a multi-billion dollar industry in small market cap frauds in America. Some place that the injuries every year at the neighborhood of $5 to $7 billion that are individuals who are taken advantage of. And this provides a medium in which they can do this. There's some history of this. The SEC flirted with crowdfunding in 1999, quickly reversed that rule because of massive, what was known as then as a microcap frauds by slick artists coming in and taking advantage of individuals and stealing off into the night. Now, there's a number of provisions in the crowdfunding bill that was added at the last minute to address some of these concerns. It remains to be seen how well that'll work.
Kathy, have you seen this law, and how do you feel about it?
I've seen it a bit. I think I am ambivalent about it. I think it's very important and exciting to acknowledge that securities law, should be updated to reflect the times, and that we have new tools and technologies to allow entrepreneurs, to access different kinds of capital. Totally on board with that. Also, like many other people, very worried about how we actually implement this so that people are not taken advantage of, and so the whole thing, doesn't fall aside as a mistake. I'm encouraged by, some of the thoughtfulness that's in the current bill and some of the thoughtfulness that's going into some of the governance structures that will be in place by the time you're actually able to do this. But as far as, I have had conversations with many people in the impact investing space around this who have, kind of been championing it. And there is ambivalence across the board. People are kind of having a wait-and-see attitude of, let's let some other people make some mistakes first and then learn from that before we get, before we lose a lot of the reputation risk, that goes along with flubbing this up in the first year.
Right. That's the big fear, of course. If you mess it up, that messes up the idea for a long time. But aren't we in that space now where we have to take these chances? I mean, in 2008, the people who are supposed to be protecting all of us failed miserably, right? And we thought we had lots of good rules in place. So it can't.
But I think there's some combination. I mean, I've been talking to Angel Networks, obviously affiliated with Investor Circle, and Bonnie was on a few minutes ago, both locally, nationally, and globally, who are looking at this new rule. And I think people are really struggling with, is it okay to look at an early stage investment completely online, right? That the high touch thing that we were talking about earlier in the hour is really important. And what kind of information can you really get, and what can you trust, through solely a technology source? So I think what we're going to see over the next year is a great deal of experimentation about how to blend the high and the low together.
It seems to me the big risk would be if you're promising huge returns, that could attract people that may or may not be particularly interested in your business. Those people might be ripe for fraud, unlike, let's say, slow money, where I know the person who's going to make the restaurant and they're good friends. And by the way, they've only promised me a 2.5% return on this.
It's not just the return, it's also the structure. Imagine they've promised you a 2.5% return, and there's a peer group on the ground in North Carolina who's vetted that t-shirt company, right? But then you list that online, and what you're trusting is not the listing, but the people who vetted it, right? That's kind of what we need to do. We need to combine the vetting and the listing so that the real world relationships empower the trust.
Well, I think there's another risk out there too, and that's the one I've always feared, that if people do invest in this company and it's the first, let's say, early stage round of financing, As businesses grow, they go back and they go to angels and they go to Venture Capital 1, Venture Capital Firm 2, and Venture Capital 3. And each one of those are different rounds of financing. And you go through a process called the round down. And that is the process in which if you're issuing more equity, which is what the angels want and Venture 1 and Venture 2 want, they want more equity, and that's going to dilute everybody who is in front of them. And the way that works out now is that the individuals that Bonnie represents and herself and the people that you teach, Kathy, et cetera, like that, they're all sophisticated. They're at the table. They negotiate about how we're going to deal with this possible dilution of our interests. The individuals who are likely to be investing in the crowdfunding provisions aren't at the table. They're, by definition, going to be unsophisticated largely. If this firm really does take off, they'll be diluted out of existence. And so that's a risk into the future, but I think a very real risk.
That does seem to be one of the rules that you could write in, that this is a special case, and so therefore we can't issue much more equity or put a cap on that. If you want to go this route, there's a real limit on how much you can issue later.
And, the problem with that is, and we talked about that and working with people on this legislation, The fear there is that chokes off the growth in the future where the real jobs are. That it's interesting, these hearings, Frank, is that the data that was being produced showed that startups, by and large, don't create the jobs. We're talking about the small business jobs. Their firms are much larger than the startups that are still small businesses that create the jobs.
It makes me wonder, Kathy, if we're not smarter to start out, if this is what we really want to do, jumpstart. We know there's all these good ideas. Capital is choked off. What do? Let's not start with equity investment. Let's just make some loans at an interest rate. Use crowdfunding to do that. People get it. They get that there's an interest rate. There's a limit to that. And then if the thing takes off, we start, we talk about IPOs.
Yeah. And that's happened already before this bill. There's an organization in Washington, D.C. called the Calvert Foundation, which issues community investment notes, which you can buy for as little as $20 on MicroPlace today. And you are not guaranteed, but you are given what has been historically a 1% to 2% return. And they have had no defaults in 10 years.
If we opened up, if how much of growth, how far could we go with that sort of a model, with that kind of not of greater emphasis on community investment and interest return bond kind of interest?
There are certain kinds of things that are ready for debt, and certain kinds of enterprises that cannot pay the cash. So it's a partial solution.
Hmm. Yeah, the problem with startups is that they usually don't have a lot of tangible assets that can be subject to a mortgage or security interest. Cash flows are limited, if it exists at all. And so it doesn't meet what we talked about earlier. And it's also small amounts of money, so the commercial banks don't lend money. When you do it one-off, as was being discussed by Carol, then you can negotiate interesting terms, and creative people can come to creative terms. And that I think that's a very hopeful sign of what Carol was talking about.
Jim, I'd like to get your thoughts on our earlier discussion on slow money and whether or not you think markets are going to have to make an adjustment just given the velocity at which money changes and the frequency of the crashes.
You know, I think that there is a growing a wave of sustainability and local going on in our society. Where that takes us, that's a very good question. But it's amazing to me that we have so many startups going on in Durham, North Carolina. But as I go to other towns, they're championing them too. I mean, there's something happening in America right now. And, I think it is a new era. And I think a lot of it's going to turn on local financing and local contacts.
Kathy, from the Academy, the Jobs Act and its fallout, a pretty good grist for study for you?
Absolutely. It's going to be an exciting time over the next few years to see what plays out and to try to understand how to make it better.
You know, Jim, you said something about the fact that the startups really don't count for most of the jobs. It's those small businesses that are up and running. So any thought to sort of how they can grow in this capital-starved economy?
Yeah. I mean, I think they do face an awful lot of regulation. And unfortunately, what got lost in the discussions and the jobs bill was the need to do a better job of scaling regulation. Regulation, by definition, always has a very high fixed cost component associated with it, and therefore this impacts the small firms disproportionately. And, we need to do a better job of balancing that, particularly in the security areas. I know, pretend to know something about corporate law and securities regulations. They really do hammer the small firms.
You go from startup to big company right away, and suddenly you have to hire a department just to handle
exactly
the
right. And we saw this instance with Facebook trying to avoid trying to be public, and it crept into that. And that's part of the jobs built resolution too.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. James Cox is the Brainerd Curie Professor of Law at Duke University. Kathy Clark is an Adjunct Associate Professor at the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship at the Fuqua School at Duke. Thank you for being on the program.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. You know, you can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Nguyen. Megan Modafferi is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Our managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.